Larry and Barbara Collins, with the assistance of Paul Hain and myself, and many others, have planned a day which I hope there's some thread of continuity throughout. Something like that, anyway. And I'm sort of going to set up the situation as it now exists. In times past, I have sort of viewed with alarm and summarized with statistics sort of the present situation. In a sly way, they suggested that I not do that this year. And it was perhaps fortunate, since I had left my notes at home. But I made another set. I'm going to very briefly summarize some of these, but I am going to view with alarm in certain areas. And I hope to perhaps straighten out some misconceptions relative to our environment. I'm going to point out some sort of new thinking where it has occurred in some of the problem areas, or in some areas that you might not know as much about, having read Time and Life magazine, or whatever you do read in this area. There's a lot of flack in this area, and one of the great pollution problems today is the written word. I'll have more to say about that later. Now, the situation that we are now in is sort of best described in a little story. I think I told it here maybe several years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, and that's about par for most of my stories. They're at least that old. But these three fellows were heading for the railroad station, and they went down to it quite rapidly. They thought they were late. But they were probably late, but the train was also late, later than they were. So they repaired to the local bar, had a couple of martinis, as is the unfortunate custom, and suddenly they realized the train was already in the station. And so one of them stayed to pay the bill, and they all charged out to catch the train, which was then moving from the station. Two of them caught the last car. The last person sort of stood there very dejected, watching the train as it left. And he stood there quite a while, in fact, long enough for the station master to come out, and he looked at this dejected figure and says, I'm really sorry you missed this train. And he says, me sorry? He says, I came down to catch the train. Those other two guys came down to see me off. Well, that's sort of, where we are, many of us, as this thing says, victim. I mean, we are victims to an extent of the products of science and technology. We're on a train which we would probably, in some days, rather not be on. And we're on a train in which there isn't really one person in the engine cab who knows where we're going. Most of us are sitting in the caboose, looking out and back, seeing where we've been, and viewing with alarm. Some of us have some communication from the caboose up front, and there are some, I think, some positive approaches being made to communicate with the engineer or engineers. And I'll also have something probably to say about that before I finish. You may interrupt at any time, because the kind of lecture I'm giving here today, I mean, it doesn't really affect it any time it's interrupted. Now, but one of the first misconceptions that I'd like to square away is that we think that this is only a product, say, of a consumer society, a materialistic society such as our own, and that pollution is something of the recent past and a man-made. All right, let's look at the man-made thing first. Nature itself is a very great polluter. Volcanic eruptions, for example, I have more to say about this when I get to particulates in the atmosphere, but the Krakatoa, or whatever it was, you know, in the Indies, or East Indies, Well, anyway, down in the Philippine area. In 1883, I remember it was a year after my dad was born. I don't remember it, but I recall it. And this thing, you know, it blew its lid, and it sort of almost darkened the whole earth for hundreds of miles, and it affected the sunset for long periods of time. And Larry will tell you about some of that around here probably today. And so this has happened many times in history. Or take the, from a conifer forest, the terpenes emitted are really airborne contaminants in high amounts. Or take the pollens that affect so many of you, and affect Mary and all these other people, and all this dust, terrific dust storms. Well, some of you say, well, it didn't have any dust till man came. I'm not quite ready to believe that. So we do have many contaminants from nature. And it isn't restricted only to this United States. It's behind the Iron Curtain, too. And when I was in Geneva just a couple of weeks ago, the river there, right in Geneva, flowing through, is one of the most contaminated rivers in the world. Because they don't have any restrictions, hardly at all for it. This is kind of surprising. It was very surprising to me. But you look at the beautiful Blue Danube. Boy, what a mess that is, huh? Or the Rhine. It's a real garbage dump. Or the in the industrialization of some of the Eastern Bloc countries, for example, they haven't applied some of the restrictions that we have. So you have tremendous problems, and it's very old. For example, in the 13th century, the coal burning in England, say in London, it made such a mess that I think it was King Edward I says, "Boy, nobody burns coal, or you're dead, man, you're dead." And they, you know, it was a death penalty for burning coal. The first Clean Air Act, you know. They kind of forgot about it after a while. Now they've gone back to nothing quite this stringent. So this is an old problem. But for our time now, we have sort of come to this, that it's like Pogo. We have discovered the enemy, and it is us. It is us. I mean, right here in the village, you know. I remember when I first did this, we had this place all policed up. To use, if you'll pardon the expression, the you know, people will run around and, you know, you throw your wrappers or your plastic things or anything else wherever you happen to be. When I go to Heart Lake, which is my favorite lake on earth, and I go up there and I find all kinds of stuff along the trail and around the lake, it really wheels me off. It's bad enough to see them along the freeways in California. But when you do it to that, I have a pretty short fuse, and if I see you do it, it really wheels me off, so I'll probably tell you off so you can get ready for that. Today, we're having a cleanup, and it's cost me quite a few ice cream cones down here, but they're going to do this by about 10:30 today. They're going to go around the area and clean up, and I'm watching because there's a great big paper box, cracker box or something behind this building. Because I usually sit up there and listen to lectures, but I also watch the birds out the window. And then I see this paper, and it's very disturbing to me. All right, now I'm going to just run through some of the what the situation is. You know, we always think of the three forms of matter, solid, liquid, and gas, and that's just as good a way as any, I thought, to just sort of review this. And our solid waste thing, I don't know if you've really ever thought about, you know, the level of our contamination. And I'm going to be interested to see what old Paul Haynes says about this. Because they're all, you know, the first guy hasn't got a chance, you know. Everybody else can, you know, take off from here. And that's part of my purpose. But whenever I think of solid waste, and really all our waste, I am moved to say that we as a country cannot afford, we do not have the resources to allow everyone to have the standard of living that I enjoy and that we enjoy, and to create the ways that we enjoy. We just do not have it. Now, that should cause you to do some real thinking. And this is really, you can really see it in the solid waste. Because right now, every one of us produces about 5 pounds of waste a day that has to be taken care of some way or another. And we have progressed, you see, as time has gone on. We've gone from paper, which is sort of biodegradable, into materials that are not biodegradable, things that last forever almost, plastics. Or if you burn them, you know, they issue phosgenes or some toxic materials. So we're getting better and better at producing more solid wastes that last longer. And that's a real problem. It's costing you and I, as citizens of this United States, about $2 billion a year to take care of this. And that ain't hay. We're described as a nation knee-deep in garbage, firing rockets to the moon. And you know, we always used to think, you know, you throw it away. But we've run out of a ways. And this was brought up at the last hour about, you know, the garbage dumps. So we have to move, and Paul will probably get to this, but we have to move towards reusable things. And when you go to the store, you know, give it to me here, you know, and you carry it home. And you wash your hands when you get there. Well, we do that in Europe, don't we? I mean, you buy a loaf of bread. It isn't wrapped. We wrap it with something we have to get rid of. Now the water. I think it was, when we discuss poverty, and we're going to hit poverty a little bit today, because that's a real problem, and it relates to what we're talking about. You know, the quality of life. It certainly is a very significant thing, and I'll have more to say about that at the end. But in looking at the population problem, nutrition problem, we realize that the population multiplies on a geometric scale. I mean, it's really going like this. And the food isn't, our food resources, our available food is not going up at the same rate. So it's getting worse all the time. But the food resource is increasing. We are making advances, such as I mentioned during the film yesterday. But when you talk about liquid or water supplies, you can say that the population of the world is increasing geometrically, while the water supply remains constant. It isn't quite that good, because available good water is decreasing. And your Great Lakes, some of you people who live near it, that represents, I think, 25% of the freshwater supply of the world. And you people who live around it haven't done very well by it. Take Lake Erie and the rest of it. I mean, it's in sad shape. I won't go through it because most of you know this situation. But it's a real tragedy. By 1980, we will have enough waterborne waste to consume all of the oxygen in the 22 river systems of the United States at low water levels. And that's bad, because that affects, of course, the biota of the river, the biota that we're interested in. Now, I'm going to give you a word here. You know, it's nice to, you know, pull big words on your friends. And there's a word that's called eutrophication. And Barbara will probably bring this up. Plan ahead, you see here. Eutrophication. That's how we sort of handle this whole thing, you know, we plan ahead. And this is what's happening to a lot of our streams and our lakes. And this simply means that you're adding a fertilizer. You're adding phosphates and nitrogens to them. And eventually, with this kind of a of additions, of contamination, of pollution. You have what probably will happens to some swamps. They go to bogs and then they fill in. In fact, some people predict that the Great Lakes, and give it about 1,000 years, it'll probably be a solid, sort of filled in. We have this big thing, for example, at Lake Tahoe. You know, the people all think it's a great place. They go there and then they fertilize the lake, and pretty soon it starts turning green. The eventual of this is the green tide, and probably Barbara will get more into this because she knows a lot more about this than I do. But it fertilizes and things grow in there, and things that you'd rather not have there. The so-called blooms. And probably it's well also to discuss, although I'm going to get at it tomorrow. Now in this discussion today, I am not talking about radiation, which is also a potential pollution, and in some places an actual pollutant. I'm going to address that tomorrow as I discuss nuclear energy peril and plowshare, to show you the hazard as well as the benefit of this thing. And it is a benefit from the standpoint that it's going to help us clean up some of this mess. But thermal pollution has come into great prominence recently, and whenever people think of thermal pollution, they usually only think of nuclear power reactors, where in reality, any electrical generating plant pollutes thermally. Or almost anything we do, we pollute thermally. A good example of this is the World Trade Center in downtown Manhattan. Just the heat output from this building into the Hudson River, at the point of discharge, the Hudson River temperature is increased 10 degrees, you know, at low water. Well, that's quite a bit. And Barbara is going to get to this balance of nature. And when you do something like that, you put that kind of an input into it, that becomes a real problem. Because there is a sort of balance in nature. Although I should say that we have had many deaths from man-made pollutants, probably nothing equals, say, the deaths that have probably occurred, the excess deaths due to heat waves, just from natural heat. I think that's enough for water. Now, some of you, you know, will raise questions. You can raise them as we go along, or when we get into it, when I open it up for discussion. On particular... Yes, go right ahead.
Are you leaving the water now?
Yes, I'm leaving the water. I haven't discussed the ocean.
You know how far we've come along on the East Salem of the seawater?
Well, I have some traffic with that from the standpoint of using nuclear reactors and this type of thing. Yes.
Is there any significant
progress here? Yes, we of course have built, we have one operating in San Diego that was more of as a model, and now they're putting in a nuclear reactor kind of a thing that's got a lot of people shaken up, because they're going to change, say, the saline content, because they got to get rid of some of this. You're trying to get just the fresh water out. It's going to change some of the elements in it, and it's also going to change the temperature. So I don't know how fast this thing will go. But we have to go to this in California and in many other places in the world. We have to go to, I guess, desalination. We're having to reuse the water many times.
Yeah, what about the reclamation of water, using sewage water for reclamation?
Yeah, in fact, some plants are using the entire production of certain sewage plants for their own plant, because a lot of times that water is cleaner than what came in. I don't know, you've probably visited sewage plants where you go through the sewage plant and see this mess, and then you finally get to the end, and then they give you they offer you a glass of water. And it ain't bad, you know. I mean, it tastes better than the water in some cities I've been in. But that's what we're doing. We're really, you know, I'll never forget when I was raised in Western Washington. I'll never forget this. Let's see now, we were judging at Enumclaw, or Buckley. I forget now. Buckley or Enum cloth. We always call it Enum scratch. And I went into the boys' room, the boys' sandbox, and I saw there was a sign over the john. It said, "Be sure to flush this because Buckley needs water." You know. Well, that's the situation we're in. You know. Boy, you better flush because the next town needs water. Because we are reusing and reusing and reusing. That's the situation we're in. And more so every year.
Leo, what do you think about, is it selfish that Washington does not want to sell water from the Columbia River to down to Arizona, for instance?
I think so now. I didn't used to think so when I lived in Washington. Now I'm in California, and I think it's very bad that you're doing that. There is, of course. I mean, you know, you get out toward beyond Portland, and there's a lot of water that other people need. At that time, I thought that's where you ought to take it, and under serious consideration, you know, is an underwater pipe along the coast, and then take it back out down below. There's many plans on how to do this. This whole water game, it's getting to be almost, you know, open warfare.
There was just in Portland this last week, there was just a small little deal. The town of Sandy had to shut down the creek to the people because the fish hatchery needed all the water that it had. So about 100 people in the community were cut off from their water supply.
The fish took precedence.
The fish took precedence. Water rights, the law of water.
Yeah, you have some unusual things happen here, like the Delaware River, I think it was, in times of And you have several situations like this where the water in the river goes way down. So in a bay where you have a lot of oysters that depend on having low saline water, a little bit but not very much, to really do well in. This again is this whole ecosystem that Barbara's going to talk about. Well, if the water gets down low, the salt encroaches on the oyster beds. And the oyster borer, you know, it comes in and has a field day, eats up all the oysters. Because he has to have a higher saline. So that, you know, it busts up the situation. You have a point.
So far as you know, has any research been done on disposal of sewage waste separate from a water system so that this doesn't necessarily enter the water?
No. There's the outhouse concept.
Yeah, now I was in German in prison camp. They had the old honey pot, and they got it and still got them, you know.
aside from the old moon house.
Yeah. Which, of course, is the way they do it in many places.
They make natural gas out of explosives. They do.
They are. I'll tell you what. There is a proposal. And it may already. I think the money. The money is allotted I've seen the plans to it, out of Stanford Research, to have sort of a little factory in the town where you haul the stuff in and reclaim this stuff. And of course now, is it Coors Beer and a lot of these others who make aluminum, use aluminum cans for beer, you know, they pay you, you know, to, and they're reclaiming that because, see, aluminum is worth a couple of $100 per ton to reclaim, so.
Well, you know, something housewives can do is switch to all when they're washing, things like that.
That's right. Okay. And yeah, and be,
I mean, things like Tide and Shear and all that stuff.
That's right. And we're going to get to that tonight on just what is the solution to all this. And Paul is going to spend about 27 minutes I'm giving you the sort of the summary of this, and then we're all going to tell how we think, or how where he's wrong or where he's right, and then we're going to tell him how what we think we ought to do, and be sure to bring this up about biodegradable snow. Anything else at this point before I go to the air? Okay, just if I can't see you, just holler. Now this air bit, and I think you've all. I mean, almost every week or something. You know, we find out, how awful the air is. And it's sort of getting worse. I mean, you just have to fly into some of these places. In Seattle, near where I was born, you know, I was really surprised when the chief and I drove in there the other day. Or even in our area, it's even encroaching on Davis from Sacramento. And in the Bay Area, it wasn't very many years ago, you know, Willie, when that was a pretty clean place. And boy, it's really getting bad now.
All within the last two years.
That's right. It's really disheartening. And these pollutants are many. And so I think you know some of this, and I will come back to some of it. But the thing that has come up recently on this, fairly recently, is the concern with the particulates. The particulates, especially up in the higher altitudes, up to about 80,000 feet. Now, there are some people like Ken Watt, who's on our campus, and it was mentioned, he was pictured in Time here a few weeks ago. And a lot of these fellows are sort of wild men, you know. I mean, we think of Ken as a wild man. He sort of refers to himself as sort of a wild man. Barry Commoner, who is an amoral opportunist, he's one of these fellows. So we have a lot of these modern-day Jeremiahs who I think it's wrong to call them that. I mean, that's what Time magazine called them. I think it's an insult to Jeremiah. But you know, they're viewing with alarm. But Ken Watt, and I had lunch with him the other day, because I wanted to ask him about this, and he was making some statements about radiation that just weren't right. They were wrong. I know. And his concern is with the particulate material in the atmosphere. We think of cars, you know, as polluting it with gaseous material. We kind of forget something that DuBose told me. He's a Rockefeller. He says, you know, the biggest contributor to particles in the atmosphere are brake linings and tires. You know, the wearing of the tires. Now, I don't know how many of you thought of this colloid sort of in the air, but that's an important material. The exhaust from the airplanes and all of our industry, of course, are putting small particles into the atmosphere up to 80,000 feet. Now, what is the result of this? The result of it, says Watt and many other people, is twofold. You're going to end up cooling the Earth. And in fact, if you examine carefully the temperature since 1945, you will realize that there has been a slight decrease in the temperature in these United States. It's less than a degree. But it is of some significance because up to 45 there seemed to be an increase. Now you can say, well, maybe this is only a cycle. But this is now, what is it, 25 years, isn't it? And it's decreasing. Now the reason they say is this. It's the particulate material in the air that is decreasing the incident rays of the sun on the earth. And the effect of this is twofold. If you reduce the temperature from 3 to 11 degrees, somewhere in that range, we will reduce the balance so that, you know, the snow will keep piling up. And number one, with the melting will sort of cease. In the northern climes, the snow area will be pushed south, and we will enter another ice age. And that's, you see, you're dealing, this isn't very many degrees. And probably the second thing is probably worse, because you're going to lose plant productivity, because, as you know, you don't grow things too well in the shade. And we're going to have more and more shade. The growing season is going to be shorter, and of course the incident solar radiation will be decreased. And to substantiate this, Watt says, you know, I went back and I read, I looked up all of the times when we had volcanic eruptions of considerable dimension, so that there were particulate materials suspended in the upper atmosphere for long periods of time. And then I looked at the papers or the the reports for the period following this in the country. And always, the price of agricultural products went up to indicate that there was a decrease in productivity. And he says there wasn't, you know, Ben Franklin ran the experiment on this, he said. He said, you know, he was checking to see how long it takes with a magnifying glass to light, to cause paper to burn. And he noted that after a volcanic eruption that was of some dimension, so that it affected his area, he noted for quite a period of time that took a longer time to cause the paper to burn. In other words, it was shadier. So this is Ken Watt now, but he isn't the only one that says this. There's quite a few people that say this. Other people will say, well, but we're increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by some fantastic amount. I'm not going to tell you because I can't remember, but it's about 10% increase over the last few decades. Now, you can have what we call a greenhouse effect with this. The greenhouse effect meaning that you're increasing the temperature of the Earth. But apparently this particulate material increase is overriding this. At least this is what some of them say. And there are some who say that because of just the jet traffic between Chicago and New York and that area, and it is terrific. I mean, if you've ever, boy, I travel a lot and I sit on O'Hare, you know, waiting to get off. And it's awful. What a place to sit. But and that's Chicago. There's one place worse, I think, and that's J.F. Kennedy, New York. But the air traffic back and forth and the jet trails has an effect. There's less incident solar radiation in the path of the jets there. Now, I don't know if they've, if this has reached the stage of a bad effect. Now, a few more minutes now on a few of the other things that you might not have thought so much about. Well, you should have, though, and that's noise. And this is something that I feel rather strongly about. Right now, we say that human hearing may be affected by 85 decibels. This is a rating to describe sound. It's on a logarithmic scale. And this is on what we call the A scale, which takes cognizance of the sort of higher pitched sounds. Now, at heavy traffic in New York, it's about 90 decibels, or in many of the other areas where you have this kind of thing. Now, the Surgeon General says, he's made the statement recently, that from 6 to 16 million people are going to have some deafness from occupational noise. And in this regard, your rock and roll is probably one of the great hazards in this regard. I think if you tested the children today, or the young adults, you'll probably find maybe an average of, 20% maybe decrement in those who really, you know, have it turned up high in their hearing. So if you are young, you want to make money, probably if you go into the hearing aid business here in, you know, a few decades, it'll probably be a great increase in this. Now, there's another aspect of this noise, of course, is just that there's something beside effect on the ear. Because your blood vessels constrict, there's a marked effect on muscle tension. Adrenaline starts flowing, it's pumped into the system sort of thing, so your blood pressure increases, it affects the heart and the nervous system. And it just makes you harder to live with. There's also increase in fetal wastage, because they've actually looked at people who live near airports. This was done in Tokyo. And you find out there's more miscarriages and this type of thing. Well, those people who live near the airports. Maybe that's one way of reducing the population, but I don't recommend it. Or you have this situation, and sometimes perhaps you've felt this way. Like a fellow in New York one day, 5 o'clock in the morning, that's, you know, when the garbage starts being picked up there or something. Well, in fact, they do it all night. There's a friend of mine is in charge in a sanitary department in New York, and he told me about all the problems they have. But one day, at 5 o'clock, they're rattling the cans and making a whole pile of noise down there. And this fellow in his pajamas or nightshirt or whatever he's wearing, he came down, he was up in an apartment house, he came down and he grabbed the garbage man, you know, by the scruff of the neck. He's a big guy, in the seat of the pants, and he ran headfirst into the garbage can. I mean, it just got too much for him, you know. Well, some of them don't go this way. Another thing, and probably this is as good a point as any to bring up the SST. Now, I know you people from the Seattle Everett area are really uptight on this, because it's like being green, you know. I mean, it smells green. Because it's a lot of money here. You as taxpayers may be investing about, it'll probably get up to about $3.5 billion for the SST, which is the supersonic transport, you know. It's going to get you to Europe a little sooner, because it's going to go at about 1,800 miles an hour instead of 600 miles an hour. And it's flying at rather high altitude. Now, in day before yesterday's paper, there was an announcement that they're re-looking at it again from the standpoint of weather. You see, there's not only the noise problem, and it is of some dimension, because the sonic booms, and they've run some studies on this, and I'll just recall one for you. I think it was in Chicago, checking the effect of sonic booms in a period of, I think, of 1 year, where they had 49 flights. There were 6,000 complaints, 3,000 damage claims, and $114,000. Now, this is just for 49 of them, you know. And so they realized that the sound problem here on your supersonic transport is significant. There's also part of this money is being allotted also for studying the effect on weather, because they feel that this thing traveling at the height it is, you may have an effect on the weather. And also, you're going to have an effect on delicate instruments on Earth. And so they have to study that out. So this is, we're finally coming around to, you know, looking at all aspects of this, and they're allotting about $25 million just to study some of these effects. I don't know if that's enough, but you are going, if you're going to fly this thing over our country at frequent intervals, you're going to have a lot of cracked plaster and an effect on instruments, no question about it. So you might want to discuss that. Now, our problem, by the basis for our problem, is, of course, the automobile. And I don't know if you've ever thought about the true dimension of the automobile. I often use it when I'm talking about the hazards of radiation or nuclear reactors. Because, I mean, we always say we balance risk versus benefit. And in the cars right now, this year probably we lose 57,000 people dead due to automobiles. 57,000 dead in this country. 2 million people will be injured. Some of them, you know, for life. Now, that's just one price of the automobile. And as you examine it as to its effectiveness in utilizing the resources and getting you there, you can only say, I guess, that it is convenient, although in many cases it isn't as convenient. In many places today, you'd be better off getting on your bicycle. You'd get there sooner. And I was going to, I just had this... this chart here, I just wanted to show you a thing that we sometimes forget, and you can take Berkeley. Berkeley is a town in California that has some problems, some problems that are different from others, but it's probably representative from this standpoint, that, and it has quite a few parks. It has one less right now, but there's about 28 square feet of park in Berkeley per person. But for each car, it takes 968 square feet in roads and, you know, in places to park and so forth. I mean, it takes a lot of land. 26% of the land surface in cities are probably set aside just because of the automobile. Now, for the similar space, if I put up here the number of passengers per hour that can utilize a given piece of earth, we have about 3,600 autos that can use it. And these are the number of passengers. 60,000 on the bus, 42,000 on a train, and this is figuring the train only half full, and 10,000 on a bicycle. And I'm happy to say that in the town of Davis, where I live, there's one of the attractions of this place, is that there's more bicycles registered than there are cars. And in much of the day, when school is going on, you can't get on the campus with a car. In fact, if you go there during class change, you'll be fine if you manage to get through the barriers. But, you know, sort of everybody rides a bike. It's a higher bicycle population than anywhere outside of Holland. And so it's really great. And walking, you can get 6,300. You know, almost double what you can get auto. So the efficiency here, working back up, in relation to the car, is rather substantial just for land utilization. You know, and this was rather impressive to me. 60% of our air pollution that we have today is from the internal combustion engine. 60% of it. And it might be worse than that because of the nature of the pollutants, you see. And because of this, and you've seen these pictures, they're very impressive, you know. These children in Japan, you know, wearing gas masks. Or the signs in L.A. now, you know. On smoggy days, you don't jump, hop, or skip rope, or things like this. You don't want to exert yourself too much. And because of this, sort of in L.A., 10,000 people per year are told by their doctor, you better get out of town. You better get out of town. And it's chiefly due to this. And something, well, we're hearing a lot more about it now, is lead. You know, the increase in lead, especially near freeways, with 5/10 parts per million in your blood, you're going to show an effect. And we have reached... about 1/3 of this now in many people. And we don't know the effect of this because the experiment has not been run. I mean, we're running the experiment, but we don't have any real good controls. And so we can go in. And of all these, we usually think of 7 or 8 contaminants from the automobile. The particulates, the oxides of nitrogen and carbon monoxide. I had a little thing here on carbon monoxide. I'll see if the time permits. But as you look at all these things, and again, you can run the comparison with the auto, bus, train, and walking, and the bicycle. And you see that, again, the auto, except in really probably in one area, and that is the particulates. For passenger mile and all, the others have them beat. Now, you said, why not the aeroplane? You know, well, when we get into that, then that's another problem. They use even more gasoline than the car, or, you know, more hydrocarbon fuel. But looking at these, and this brings up now another dimension to show you the complexity of this. Busted's third law says this. There is no complex problem if looked at in the right way doesn't become more complex. And that really shows up here because, you know, you think of a few things and then you suddenly realize, like the fuel. A car that carries usually 1.5 people uses 4.4 gallons per 100 passenger miles. Now, I don't expect you to remember this, but it's in the relationship to these other things. So it consumes over 80 billion gallons of fuel per year. Now, that's a terrific consumption of fuel. And if to put it in dimension for you, if all people use the same... on the earth, use the same number of cars as we do, and heaven forbid, we would use up the entire Alaska oil find, you know, which is probably one of the largest that have been discovered in recent times. We'd use it up in 4 years, just feeding these cars. But we have this problem of hauling oil, just to show you how this problem multiplies. Just to get these super tankers to haul this. And you all remember the Torrey Canyon off London, off England. You know, that was about 100, it was over 100,000 tons. And it lost its oil, contaminated on the beaches of France and England. And it was a real mess, huh? Well, and the recent thing in Santa Barbara. And still just leaking it. And also to drive this home to you, I think there were about 400, close to 500 tankers that are, you know, big tankers in use over the last 10 years. And of these 500 tankers, there were over 500 accidents by these tankers. In other words, it averaged more than one each wreck per tanker over the 10 years. And of these, some of them weren't serious, but there were 43 possible oil spills from these. Now, we are not satisfied with 100,000-ton tankers. We have gone to 300, we're now on the drawing board, 300,000-ton tankers. And when you lose one of these, you really got some. You really got some. So that's part of our problem. And we use, you know, we use big cars. This is a problem we'll probably talk about tonight. Now, I want to leave some time for discussion. I'll just say that on carbon monoxide, there again, we really don't know what low levels for a long time exposure, what kind of an exposure at low levels, what this does for you over the long haul. We do know that if you have 10 parts per million, you end up with about a 2% what we call carboxyhemoglobin. What does carbon monoxide do? If you see it's absorbed in your blood, and it ties onto the hemoglobin, and the hemoglobin is what carries your oxygen in your blood. Well, the CO, the carbon monoxide getting in there, ties onto the hemoglobin, so it keeps that hemoglobin that's tied that way from carrying oxygen. See, so you reduce your oxygen capacity in the blood. Well, what has happened is that if you go to 2%, they've actually run some tests now and find out that even with this level, you have an increase in traffic accidents, an increase in death rate among heart attack patients, and a decrease in athletic performance, even with that level. And I should point out that 10 parts per million of CO, carbon monoxide, is a characteristic of Los Angeles today, and that in many of the tunnels, like the Boston Tunnel, they go up to 120 parts per million. And cigarette smokers, of course, are up very much higher than of course, 10 parts per million. So this becomes a real problem, and this is where some of the research effort will be, I think, directed. And once you get it in, it takes a 3 to 4 hour washout time. And the chemicals, you've heard a lot about pesticides, and one of the concerns on pesticides today, you've probably heard about radiation causing mutation. And they do. It does cause mutation. But recently, one of the great geneticists of our country, Old Crow, not Old Crow, I'm sorry, Dr. Crow, at Wisconsin, says that many of these chemicals are probably have a greater effect, are really more effective mutagens than the radiation exposure that you might be exposed to. And it does affect the DNA molecule, and some of you have heard about DNA because it ruptures. Even some of the fungicides that are so-called non-toxic are now being found to be mutagenic. That is, they cause mutations and possibly cancer. So that's a real problem. Now, sort of where are we now setting it up for tomorrow sort of thing? You know, man started out, he's sort of a man against nature, and he had a real time with it. And then he sort of conquered nature and did pretty well for a while. And now we've sort of run the gamut. We're back so that that our environment is now become, again, a very real problem. And I have gone through sort of on parts on this, you know. We've taken it in segments. And recently, ecology has been the thing, and that's what you're going to hear about now from later today. To look at the planet as a single abode, to sort of put all this together. And it's hard to conceive this, the interrelationships of our environment. That's one of the things I want to say. The other thing I want to say is that as much as we're emphasizing pollution today, and a lot of people, if we ran a survey here today or many places, you would probably find the reaction is similar to that in the United States, where public opinion polls rank pollution the number one domestic problem, ahead of improving schools and expanding medical services. Now, we as a nation, we take on various things is a fad. Now, I'm not saying that this isn't a real problem. I mean, it is. It's a very big problem. But I don't want you to, you know, just get on one thing and say, this is overwhelming. But we've had a real, the mass media has swelled the enthusiasm for this. So it's sort of the cause of the year, and you sort of abandon many others. And this is very hazardous. And some of these commitments are admittedly shallow. People don't really think about what this is going to cost. And that's what Paul Hain is going to get at. And we have to say that we may be losing the brown pelican. It may disappear from Louisiana. But that doesn't mean all life will disappear. And it doesn't mean that, you know, all cities are going to be uninhabitable within a few years. This crash, and there's a tendency, you see, when this becomes a fad, to go on a crash program, which is not well thought out, where in reality we should make better plans for this. And the present administration, I think, is moving in this direction. They've appointed this committee, and I'm looking forward to the report. It was supposed to be out July 1. Russell Train, the attorney, who's a very well-known attorney, who's interested in the conservation causes. Robert Kahn, who is the Pulitzer Prize winner for the Christian Science Monitor, and he knows which questions to ask, and a fellow I know, Gordon MacDonald, who's from the University of California system, who's kind of a boy genius. He's about 40 years old. He's from Santa Barbara. But he's back, and the three of them are supposed to be sort of the keeper of the environmental conscience, a goad to the body politic, and a fount of ingenuity. And they have a budget of at least $500,000 to do this, you know. I'm not sure if it's enough. They have 15 people that are working on it, and we'll see what their first report is. So we are looking at this, and I hope kind of making long-term plans. But we should give, I think, top priority to probably the less fashionable human problems. And by this I mean fighting racism, hunger, malnutrition, rats. These aren't so popular, but they're more important. I think the people must have priority over the wildlife as much as I like it. And I think school systems still have to have priority over waste disposal systems. Our top priority should be our society, and I'll admit this feeds into it, but there are high priority items. And I'm not going to touch the population problem because that's very intimately tied up with this, but you're going to cover that, aren't you, Larry? Or did you? You're going to cover the population problem some?
Not too much.
Well, we call it the population problem, you know, because, you know, this is, and I might say something about that when we get to that. But there's also, and I mentioned it to begin with, and I'm going to close with this, and that's the pollution of words. The pollution, and this is our most serious problem, and it's our serious interrelation problem. We cause more trauma with this than almost anything else. The trouble ain't that people don't know anything. Most of what they know ain't true. Will Rogers said that, and it's still true. And it's a good gauge for all of you. As I told my associates in the laboratory, you know, I could see how, you know, always somebody's having problems. It's usually a personal problem where somebody, they told an untruth about them, or they said something they didn't like, and they're all worked up, so they're ineffective. And so I set aside, as I do it annually, and I do it more often, but we have sort of one thing we shoot for, sort of each year, I shoot for to really discuss with them. And this was this sort of pollution of words. And I said, you have three criteria in which you judge words. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it necessary? And that's pretty good criteria, you know. Maybe it might not be kind in the short run. You have to look at the long run. I mean, some things, some people have told me some things that should have been told to me. They weren't very pleasant when they were told to me, but they needed to be told. But there are some things been told to me that were unnecessary, that were untrue, and they were unkind. And so it does affect me. And it affects you, you know. I mean, and probably it affects, I mean, one it's usually the guy that sits in the hot seat that gets the most of it. Here at Holden Village, it's Carroll. I mean, there's a lot of things that come to him, you know, that are unkind. They're not true, and they're not necessary. And that's true for all of you. So remember also today and every day the pollution of words.